Hey, everybody. Welcome to Mossback, the official podcast of the Mossbacks Northwest video series from Cascade PBS. I'm Stephen Haig.
And I'm Knut Berger.
And today, we're talking about camouflage. Camo is so in style these days, you find it on clothing, bags, and accessories. Knut, of course, prefers plaid. But our conversation today concerns the greatest camo job in history, the fake neighborhood built on the roof of a giant Boeing plant in Seattle during World War II.
We are the builders of the B-17.
And the Hollywood set designer hired to create it. Why did the U.S. Army go to such great lengths for the sake of camouflage? And what other legacies did that designer leave Seattle? If you haven't already seen the video, take a few moments to watch it. It'll make this conversation more interesting and relevant. You can find the video in the show notes, but for now, we're headed down a rabbit hole to what they called Boeing Wonderland.
In huge Boeing plants, out of tough metal, they forge America's fighting bomber.
So this whole project, building a fake neighborhood on top of a Boeing plant, was a huge endeavor, expensive, I'm sure, complex. Knut, why did they go to the lengths they did?
So Boeing had been a longtime provider of aircraft to the military.
Bronze, brass, rubber. From all parts of the world, they flow into the Boeing stores.
And of course, these were some of the very earliest planes that Boeing made. In the mid-1930s, they developed a bomber, which we know as the B-17.
Mm-hmm. Across the broad face of America, into the birthplace of the B-17.
It became a very important weapon in World War II.
These are the people who get the biggest thrill. The thousands of Boeing workers who build them.
Obviously, because of the war, the production began to expand, and Boeing had built a B-17 plant down on the Duwamish River in South Seattle, right across from South Park. You know, I think you have to go back to the U.S. entry into World War II because of Pearl Harbor.
Sneak sky and sea raid on Pearl Harbor, America's mid-Pacific naval bastion.
You know, the region had always had strategic importance during the period of the Spanish-American War and after World War I. Forts were built all around Puget Sound with these big, you know, pillboxes and cannon emplacements and whatnot to protect an enemy from invading through the Strait of Juan de Fuca or the Columbia River. And, you know, the Bremerton Naval Shipyard was here, which became very, very important in the early stages of World War II. We were building ships and repairing ships. And I think that the sense of threat after Pearl Harbor really alarmed the government nationally, but also people locally.
The idea that we could be attacked.
Yes, that we could be attacked, we could be invaded. Now, and let's be clear, I mean, nobody knew what the capacity was for the Japanese to launch a strike a la Pearl Harbor on our area. So there were a lot of questions about what they were capable of. And so that was a big issue.
While bombs were still bursting and flames still pouring from our shattered naval craft, a light United States cruiser valiantly moves out to join the fleet and avenge Pearl Harbor.
It's known that in the 1930s, there were German intelligence people who came to Seattle and asked questions about Boeing and wanted to know how things were going. And the region was a big provider of strategic materials, right? Minerals, wood. You know, we produced a lot of the raw materials that the war effort required. There were incidents that occurred off of the coast of Washington that alarmed people. Japanese submarines had sunk freighters on the Strait of Juan de Fuca. The Japanese had invaded the Aleutian Islands. And you have to remember, Seattle was the next big city to Alaska. This was really considered our next door neighbor.
Japan had sunk freighters in the Strait of Juan de Fuca or off the Strait of Juan de Fuca?
Yeah, off Cape Flattery is probably more accurate. There had been a shelling of Fort Stevens at the mouth of the Columbia River. So you add up these sort of incidents. This is the kind of thing that, of course, fueled the panic in incarcerating Japanese Americans en masse. But a lot of other things occurred, which was, you know, how do we defend this place, and how do we, you know, keep from being disrupted from contributing to the war effort? And so Seattle went all in on military blackouts every night. Air raid sirens were put throughout the city, downtown. They put on Finney Ridge and other places. So some of them are still there, I think, right?
And I've read there were barrage balloons put up.
Barrage balloons put up.
The United States Army reveals for the first time the American-type anti-aircraft balloon. The idea is that the balloons, great quantities of them, stand sentinel in the skies around the city they guard.
I met a man years ago who was in the Army and manned a mobile anti-aircraft unit, which they would move from hill to hill in Seattle. And they were on top of Queen Anne Hill, Beacon Hill, you know, any high point in Seattle at some point would have one of these mobile units up there. So Seattle was very important to the Navy, to the Air Force, and of course with Fort Lewis and other military installations at Fort Lawton. We were also an important transshipment point of sending people to the Pacific to fight.
And Boeing was of, obviously, strategic importance. And just considering how many B-17s Boeing put out at that plant, plant number two, as they called it, thousands and thousands.
Yeah, I think the number that we have is somewhere around 7,000 B-17s were built for the war effort.
At Boeing.
At Boeing, yes.
At these plant.
Are, I'm sorry, yes, Boeing B-17s. Later, they also were producing the B-29s, which were long-range bombers. They didn't produce most of those in Seattle, but they did develop them here. And so if you think about the war in Europe, not just the Pacific, but the war in Europe, these B-17s are going over to England. They're bombing Germany. They're playing a huge role in the waging of the war in Europe.
I'm only one of the thousands of Boeing workers who plan, design, and build the B-17.
I wonder if you could describe what that Boeing plant looked like, just the size of it and the scale of it.
Yeah, the scale of it is amazing. It grew during the, you know, as the war went on, as production ramped up, it grew. It was eventually at least 25 acres under one roof. It employed about 30,000 people worked at this one aircraft plant.
With our hands a million strong, we milled and drilled and shear and saw.
And they worked, you know, three shifts a day. So they're going 24 hours a day.
So 10,000 people were there at a time.
Basically, yes. You would have the huge shifts. You've got a virtual army of, you know, riveters, Rosie the Riveters.
I press a button. Down comes the ram. Up goes the pressure to 4,000 tons.
Production lines were pretty amazing. And, of course, work is going on at related facilities. But this plant was essentially a giant target. You know, looking at it from a military standpoint, it's built in a place with where there are not a lot of other buildings, right? And it's obviously an industrial plant. It's right next to an airfield. If you're trying to put yourself in the mind of the enemy, you're flying a plane over, you're taking photographs of the city to find out where strategic targets are, and this would be an obvious one. So a decision was made that the Army engineers would look at strategic sites in Washington, in the Northwest, and would decide what to camouflage and how to camouflage them. In other words, let's hide these things in plain sight.
Enter a man named John Stuart Detley. Who was he and why did the Army seek him out?
Well, this to me is a fascinating part of the story is John Stuart Detley was an art director in Hollywood. He had a brother who was also in the same business and he worked from the late 30s to the early 40s. He was an art director, set designer for MGM. And of course, MGM, this is the heyday, the golden era of MGM. Spectacular musicals, great, you know, stars.
Good morning.
Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland, Jeanette MacDonald, Nelson Eddy. I mean, and films with Busby Berkeley dancers and these elaborate sets and numbers. He's right in the thick of this. And he was nominated for an Oscar in 1940. So he's a serious creative figure in Hollywood. He was also in the Army Reserve. And so when the war came along, he was called up.
Calling all set decorators.
Exactly. And he wasn't the only one. Some went down to California to help camouflage facilities down there. He was sent to Seattle. And Detley was an artist, but he was also an architect. And I think that did help him with the design. And he had a career as a successful architect after the war. One of the things he was supposed to figure out was how you hide an operating industrial facility like Boeing Plant 2, keep it running, but also hide it from the enemy.
So describe what he created. How extensive was it? What did it look like? What was it made of?
So what they decided to do was basically make it look as if the factory were just another neighborhood in Seattle. So this involved building fake homes on top of the roof, kind of low-rise Rambler-style houses. They built fake streets. They built fake gardens, trees. And of course, the issue is it didn't have to look especially realistic from the ground. It had to look realistic from a plane flying over, taking photographs. And the houses that they built were, I don't know, half size maybe. They were small and squat. They did build some full-size houses, one of which was able to accommodate like a watchman or a caretaker living in it.
So he lived on set.
He lived on set. And they used all kinds of materials. They used canvas for the streets. They used feathers for leaves on the trees, burlap for some of the roads and sidewalks. And so it looked like a miniature suburb when you were sort of standing on one of the fake streets. But from the air, it looked terribly convincing. I mean, I've seen a photograph of Boeing Plant 2 before it was built and Boeing Plant 2 after it was built. And it was amazingly deceptive. There was a news blackout on it, so nobody reported on it. Nobody was really talking about it. You know, loose lips sink ships kind of thing. Yeah, it was, you know, completed and sat there for the remainder of the war.
How long did it take to build and what were the challenges?
You know, I actually don't know exactly how long it took them to build it, but they were kind of tinkering with it all the way along. I mean, I think the challenges were several. I mean, one was, keeping it secret. There were also some issues as to how much deception to build into it. So, for example, they were doing some camouflage work at Boeing Field. They also extended some of the street grid of the fake town across Boeing Field and even up Beacon Hill on the other side to make it look like those roads actually went somewhere. So they were dealing with kind of a larger scale of deception. And the main challenge was because of the roof wasn't a big flat roof. It had these series of ventilation systems across. They had to make sure that those systems could still operate, that they didn't impede the production in the plant. At the same time, they had to hide them. And so I think they had a lot of challenges.
Why did they call it Boeing Wonderland? Who came up with that?
This is a name the public kind of applied to it, and I think it was used internally among Boeing people because the suburb was kind of a bit of an ideal modern suburb of, as you would imagine it, in the 1940s. I think it had this kind of idyllic green lawn, broad streets kind of look. Yeah, it looks like Bellevue of the 1950s.
When did Detlef start telling the truth? I mean, when did he start spilling the beans? And how long did they keep this fake town up?
Yeah, it was kept secret throughout the war. I mean, the public didn't really know about it. It wasn't publicized until, I think July of 1945. So the war was basically over.
The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That's the word we've just received from the White House in Washington. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
It was just a matter of time. The threat from Japan had been stopped. And and the government basically said, hey, guess what? Boeing employees, dressed up in their civilian clothes and went up and posed for pictures in the town. You can see some of the photographs of, women looking like they're sunbathing. And so it became this kind of, thing of a fascination for people. And it took them, they took it down in 1946. So it was up about, at least into 1946.
So let's talk more about John Detlef. He moves to Seattle for this project. What else do we know about him?
Well, the other really interesting aspect to his story and to this larger story of the Boeing plant is he married the hottest starlet of the World War II era, Veronica Lake.
Have you ever seen the love light?
They met in Hollywood. He was 13 years older. She was only 20 years old when she became a star. She started in Hollywood in her late teens, became a huge sensation in the early 40s and during World War II.
So she's the kind of star that would be plastered, her name and likeness, on the nose of a B-17.
Oh, it's so easy to imagine it. And she was the darling of women who love this hairstyle where she has the peekaboo, the hair coming down over one eye. That became kind of a signature of hers.
Veronica Lake's one-eyed hairdo established a style that swept the feminine face of the country. Veronica's witch lock received the stamp of approval from young girls the country over.
But then, yes, the GIs loved her too. And so Detlef married her and she moved with him to Seattle.
Do you know where they lived?
Well, there's some articles in the paper about their house hunting, which are kind of interesting. Miss Detlef, new neighbor. Know her? Veronica Lake. An army wife whose name is Mrs. John S. Detlef, but who was more famous as Veronica Lake, the actress, was house hunting in Seattle yesterday looking for an unfurnished six-room house with a garden in which she can putter in pigtails and overalls and a good basement where the baby's clothes can be laundered.
An army wife, right?
Yes. So she had a baby daughter by Detlef, and they ended up finding a house on Mercer Island, a small house on Mercer Island.
Of course,
Island.
Veronica Lake. Mercer Island.
So, it was interesting because Seattle didn't, necessarily have a lot of resident celebrities. And here she's this big star moving to town.
So she was involved in Seattle life, Seattle society?
Yeah, to a degree she was. She was a very private person at this point. She was not a sort of a socialite type or a social butterfly, but she was making appearances, sometimes with her husband, sometimes not, raising funds, raising awareness, selling bonds. And she did this nationally. I mean, she appeared in a number of Rally the People, patriotic film or rallies of various kinds.
Miss Lake has now decided to put glamour in its proper wartime place and face the world with both eyes in the clear. Her hair is out of the way, combed in a simple but becoming fashion. And girls all over the country who are taking up war jobs are following her lead once again.
Did folks around Seattle know generally that Veronica Lake and Mr. Detlef were here? And I'm wondering what the cloud of curiosity was like.
Well, I think people seemed to be pretty respectful. I mean, they're covering them at public events, So when she gave this interview that they were house hunting, they were staying at the Olympic Hotel. They hadn't found a house yet, and they're about to go do a big victory rally in what was called Victory Square, which is, you know, the street right outside the Fairmont Olympic Hotel today. So this was the kind of thing where she was getting coverage. In some of the coverage of her, she's making it clear that she's going to be a housewife. She has a kid. But she's also going to commute between Seattle and Hollywood to continue making films. She was under contract with Paramount at this time. So she hasn't given up movie making, but she's definitely sending a signal of like, when I'm here, I'm going to be domestic and I'm also going to keep working.
Did anybody ask what was Detlee here for?
Well, I think, no, it was well known that he was attached to the Seattle Army Engineers Department. He received a promotion at one point. That was in the newspaper. He's now goes from Captain Detlee to Major Detlee. You know, this was not at all unusual to have people coming here for military purposes. And I think, you know, people didn't necessarily trumpet what they were doing. But it also, it was reported that he was working on camouflage projects, but it was just general. You know, nobody mentioned Boeing, nobody mentioned the specific things, but camouflage was something that, you know, his group was working on.
How long were they here?
So they're here in 1942, and then in 1943, when Veronica Lake is making a movie, she's pregnant, and she has a fall on the set. The baby's born prematurely, a baby boy, and dies within just a few days. And then not long after that, she files for divorce. And by, you know, by the end of 1943, the relationship is clearly over. So we don't really know a lot about their personal relationship. I mean, there's a lot known and said about Veronica Lake in terms of kind of how her career sort of spiraled, and she developed a reputation of being very hard to work with. There were a lot of well-known actors who didn't want to work with her ever again, or some directors that she infuriated, and accusations of erratic behavior and eventually drinking. These kinds of things made their way into certainly the sort of national gossip columns. People were talking about Veronica Lake. People were, you know, reporting on the movies that she did.
It's all very noir, you know, in the very typical Hollywood noir sort of way.
Well, and she made one or two noir films too. I mean, she became associated with that genre as part of her looking at her career and her whole look, and that sort of smoky beauty. I think it was interesting, but one of the movies she made during the war, one of the movies was called The Hour Before Dawn. Came out, it was made in 43, came out in 44. And it's a war movie, takes place in England based on a story by Somerset Maugham. And she plays a Nazi spy. So first of all, it's like you're sending her out to do Bond rallies and then you cast her as a Nazi spy, really? So she's cast as a Nazi spy. And one of the things that she's attempting to betray England on is revealing to bombers the location of a camouflaged airfield.
Was so, Detlee perhaps the co-screenwriter of this epic?
It's like, was there something about their divorce being worked out here, you know? No, and that, I mean, that's, I had no idea about this until I was reading up on Veronica Lake's career. And they mentioned this movie, and it was a terrible movie. Apparently, it bombed at the box office. And I looked at it online. It's like, you've got to be kidding me.
Was it just Veronica Lake that was bad, or was everybody bad in this movie?
According to the reviewers, everybody was bad. It's not a classic work by any means.
So what happened to Detlee? So they get divorced. Does he stay in Seattle? Does he go back to Hollywood and get nominated for an Oscar for the greatest camouflage job in history? What happens to him?
He gets transferred to San Francisco for a while. I think he's at the Presidio. But after the war, certainly by the early 1950s, he's back in Seattle as a practicing architect and arts organizer. He's one of the founders of the organization called Allied Arts in Seattle.
I remember that organization.
Yeah, well, this is it's the major cultural advocate from everything from the World's Fair to professionalizing the arts, beefing up the symphony. And he was the first head of Allied Arts. I believe he was also the first head of the Seattle Arts Commission, which was founded at the same time. So in the post-war period, Seattle is still growing. Its cultural ambitions are post-dustbin. And he's right in the thick of that. In addition, he is designing major projects or co-designing, involved in the designing, everything from suburban homes to Temple to Hersh Sinai. You know, he was involved in doing some design at Children's Orthopedic. And so he was a respected and well-known mid-century modern architect in Seattle in the 1950s. And if you go online, you can find occasionally houses on the east side, beautiful mid-century houses that he designed that are for sale, you know, a John Detley home. But he's not a household word. We had, you know, many other Northwest modern architects who became famous. He wasn't one of them. But he played a really pivotal role in that post-war period relating to the arts.
Does a Detley designed home give that home stature?
Yeah, I have no idea, but certainly real estate people will throw that name in there to, you know, hopefully get someone interested.
I'll have to look that up.
I don't think he's building any fake homes on top of your home. However, or maybe he'll build a fake suburb around it.
It comes with ADUs, lots of them. What do you think the construction of this elaborate hoax says about Boeing, about Seattle, about our role in World War II? What's the big footprint left here?
I think there are a couple of things. One is that it's easy for us to think, well, World War II, we won that. It's harder to remember how afraid people were who lived here. And that doesn't justify everything people did at that time, far from it. But I know my parents were in Seattle in the, you know, for part of World War II, and they talked about how fearful everyone was. They really feared attack. They feared something was going to happen. So I think it's a reminder of the lengths that the government and others went to ensure that the defense, the key defense facilities were protected. And so I think it's one way to kind of look back at that history and see some of the things that were driving it, driving the fear, driving the overreaction. I think people were kind of amazed at how elaborate the hoax was and how much money it had cost. I think there was an estimate I saw in one of the accounts that speculated that this thing had cost, it called it the elaborate $1 million camouflage project. And this is in the newspaper in 1946 when they're tearing it down. 15 brawny steelworkers in the crews tearing down the elaborate $1 million camouflage project were going shamefacedly about the task of ripping out chicken wire netting and fiberglass lawns, canvas boulevards, and chicken feather trees. So I think it just gets us to kind of look at World War II in Seattle and the forces that were going on for better and ill.
What I think about when I read this story and see the video and others like it is World War II was something that everybody was involved in. Everybody. It affected everybody's life every day. Everybody was fully involved in World War II. Not like today when we go to war, we send one of our services, almost as if they're contractors, to go fight this war, and we pretend to not be bothered by it. It affected everybody.
Well, if you go back and look at the newspapers of that time and you see the number of local obituaries of young men from Seattle, I mean, daily reports of so-and-so is missing in action, so-and-so is dead, so-and-so, the son of so-and-so. I mean, it had a huge impact in that way. It had a huge impact on the city itself in terms of there was a growth boom. The city diversified because of people who came here to work during the war that weren't living here before the war. The impact on both sides of the incarceration of Japanese Americans, that had a huge impact on everyone, whether they knew it or not. It was very impactful. And many of these impacts lasted, they lasted after the war. They've shaped the city in a fundamental way.
Thanks for listening to Mossback. If you'd like to see all the episodes from this season of Mossback's Northwest, you can find them at cascadepbs.org. The video series is now in its 9th season. A new episode airs on Cascade PBS every Thursday night through May. This episode of Mossback was produced by Sarah Bernard. Our story editor and executive producer is Sarah Menzies. You can subscribe to the Mossback podcast wherever you listen. And whatever platform you're listening on, please review us. We'd love to know what you think of the show. And check out the show notes if you want to get in touch. Also, if you'd like to support the work we do, whether it's our lineup of podcasts, the video docuseries we stream every week, or the in-depth reporting we deliver every day, go to cascadepbs.org. In addition to supporting our journalism, members receive complete access to the on-demand programming of Cascade PBS. And being a member means you can sign up for an exclusive weekly Mossback Den newsletter from Knute Berger, where he offers greater insight into his latest historical discoveries. Mossback is a product of Cascade PBS. I'm Stephen Haig. We'll be back soon with another episode.